Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You hate the business.
You know, I hate the business end of the business because it's just, it requires the stuff that, like, I didn't plan to do. Like, why do I have to know PowerPoint? Someone forced me to learn Excel? No. And now I have to go make a mailing list of people that I want to come and please watch my, you know, next special.
What do you mean learn Excel? Because what did you have to, like, what do you have to learn in Excel? Like, just reading the sheets or putting them together or...
Opening Excel, just so...
Did you not have Excel on your computer?
I did. And I think that's why I sort of, when I was in school or when I was in college, I sort of, since I was a kid, I was like, I want to do something which doesn't require me to sit at a desk. I want to sing and I want to dance and I want to make people laugh and that's it. And I've realized now that the singing and the dancing and making people laugh also has this very, very prominent component of someone has to come and watch you singing and dancing because you can't make people laugh if they're not there.
That's what Twitter's for. No,
right. Yeah. But so that component is truly terrifying to me, actually, to be very honest with you. I sort of fumble a lot. I'm a big failure at collating documents. Like, give me Microsoft Word where I'm writing a set and I'm okay. But any other Microsoft product scares the bejesus out of me.
See, you're not the only one to say that. The amount of comedians who say to me, oh, I hate the admin side, and I'm like, you're in show business.
Yeah.
The business side you have to think about. I'm not saying you don't, but obviously you do, but it's like that involves not sitting at a desk, but at a space, for me it's a train generally, and doing the work.
Yeah.
Because no one's going to do it for me. Yeah. And all the people who've said, you know, like anytime an agent emails me and says, I'd love to meet up with you, or I'd love to do this or whatever, 90% of the time I'm like, yeah, but what can you actually do that I can't?
Yeah. I guess, you know, and I'll be honest with you, I think that is very important. But then I feel like I would rather spend my time and energy into writing, into spending time living life that would give me an observation that might not even get to a final stage of a joke, but that'll give me a minute at an open mic, that'll give me a minute at a new material night. And also because I guess of the fear and because of the anxiety that comes with this sort of... like admin work thing, then it scares me off comedy in general. Then I'm like, now I am invested in, if I want people to come and watch me, not even if I want, now I'm invested in, please come and watch me, as opposed to, I want to make people laugh.
I get what you're saying, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I guess it's a very overtly romantic and sort of unnecessarily romantic way of looking at it and very not practical. But I think, I mean, truly that's what I believe in my heart.
Just do a very quick, just say your name and...
My name is Aditi Mittal and these are my profiles.
Okay.
And this is me at an audition for Lady Yogurt. Because that literally seems to be... Okay, are we okay on the...
We're fine.
Good.
Sorry, can I ask you a very weird question? Do you want your name pronounced the way you've just pronounced it? Or can I say Aditi Mittal?
Darling, a rose by any other name
would cost the same amount around Valentine's Day.
Well said.
Thank you. Right, no, I just... No, because I don't want to get it wrong and...
That's fine.
Because that would be the worst.
I called myself Aditi Mittal while announcing myself on a show recently.
So I can call you anything.
Just
I'll
just go
be
for
like, gold. That woman, she's on the... After what we've just talked about, Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry Podcast, episode 77. I'm comedian Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, the Indian circuit. Aditi Mittal is an Indian stand-up comedian, actress, and writer. She was one of the first women to do stand-up in India, and has been included in the top 10 list of Indian comedians by the Times of India. I got her on to talk about the circuit in India versus the UK, how class issues affect and impact comedy, and what she and other comedians can say, why she found the Edinburgh Fringe a really white place to be, how she found the right agent for her, and how she deals with misogyny in audiences all around the world. I found this a brilliant interview showcasing the similarities and differences in culture and in comedy, and a perspective I've not really heard before, namely someone who had to make a job for themselves in a circuit that didn't have any role models for her to look up to or emulate, in a world where the audiences and some of her co-worker comedians didn't like the idea of a female performer. If you're new here, please do hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do leave us an honest review in iTunes. But now, without any more delays, this is Aditi Mittal.
I think the reason I started doing comedy was because, one, I don't know how to do anything else. And two, I think I just sort of hung around long enough. I think I just went to mic after mic without any shame. You know, everyone sort of seems to recall this, right? Now everyone, like, I've come to England and sort of now everyone's like, oh, look, Aditi, you know, she got a show with BBC. Wow, how great. Remember how earlier she used to do so badly? And I'm thinking to myself, dude, I don't remember doing that badly. But apparently I was doing so badly. But I just kept going up on stage. I think it was just a question of the fact that I had no shame. I really, really wanted to make people laugh, which is why I hung around long enough. And to be honest, when I started, I was not told that I was supposed to be like that a woman doing comedy was supposed to be like, wow, a monkey wrote Shakespeare. Like, I didn't know it was supposed to be that unique and amazing, which is why I kind of just went around doing it like everyone else. And finally, actually, when I started getting some, you know, attention from outside and like, you know, people started writing and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, they're like, so you are a woman in comedy. And so tell us about that. And I was like, I like to make people laugh. Like, I had nothing else to offer except that. And sort of now, as I've spent more time being on stage and woken up to the layers of what it means to be a woman in this profession.
It was a couple of years ago now, but it's still one of my favorites. Do you know Beck Hill?
No, don't I know Beck?
Oh, no, that's fine. She tweeted, it was like, interviewer, what's it like being a woman in comedy? And her reply is always, it's just like being a man, except you get asked that a lot more.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So at first I was just like, huh, I don't know how to answer that question. But I'll be honest with you, I feel like I will answer that question a million times if it means that someone listening for the first time finds solace in it. If it causes them to identify with something and if it gives them context, I will answer that question a million times if that's what it takes. When I did my special here in Soho, and I know the conventional things that women have always been accused of. Oh my god, she's talking about periods. Oh my god, she's talking about babies. I was like, yeah, I talk about periods and babies, and I hope for the next 25 generations of female comics they talk about periods and babies, because not nearly enough has been said about periods and babies that has been said about, you know, dicks and blowjobs. I mean, I think this is an equal part of the narrative. I'm 50% of the world's population. Why shouldn't I talk about periods and babies? And why should you act like you have no context on periods and babies? What's wrong with periods and babies?
It's like if I were to say, white middle class men only talk about their dead dads and ex-girlfriends.
Yeah,
if that's what they want to, talk about. Again, it's what we're talking about before we started recording. You should have the right to say, especially in comedy, you should have the right to say whatever you want to say.
Yeah.
Even if I don't agree with it or I don't think it's funny or...
Agreed, 100. And you know what? Here's the thing. I think the best way to express or register your dislike for something is not be there, is stop listening. Yeah. And I don't know why people act like it's being shoved down their throats, that they're like, oh my god, no dude, you could next time don't go for a show, you know. It's not about sort of like, now I guess because we also live in a time and age where you can register discontent, and that's a very, very good thing necessarily. But I don't think that this like maybe I'm just going off now. I don't think that this necessary sort of stereotyping, as it were, should deter people. I mean, honestly, I really don't think there has been said enough about periods and babies and dead dads. I don't think there has. Say it. Keep talking about these things. And silence is our greatest enemy. Silence is the reason why people sort of don't know what you're talking about or aren't sensitive enough to understand what you're talking about. And so just talk. keep telling your story. And I think it will just make us a more aware, more sensitive and more intelligent world. Now I've gone into official, like, vague sentences, but you know what I'm saying.
No, it makes you more empathetic.
Empathetic is the word I was looking for.
Oh, sorry. Right. Yeah. It's all right. I had 5 minutes to think about it. You didn't. But no, I agree with that. I tell people all the time, you vote harder with your money than you do with your voice. So if you don't, someone can say to me, you're shit. And every audience I do, 10% of people don't like me. I'm fine with that. Just on a statistic numbers basis, even my own show.
You can't 100% have people think you're amazing. That's just mathematically impossible.
I did my DVD record and people brought their partners and all that kind of stuff. And I could still see the 10% in the room that just were like, why did you bring me to this crap? And I'm like, you know what? I don't care that you're here. That's fine, right? I would say to them, just don't come back. There's enough people, you know, go see you. Like, it sounds like you talk about something completely different to me.
Yeah. And you know what? I think that way as a comic, I am overtly aware of the fact that we have a paying audience. I think that is my biggest driver, is when someone has paid money to come and see you, they've bought someone they love. And so your job at that exact given point in time is to roll up your sleeve and make sure you make people laugh. It is literally what you are getting paid for. But mathematically, it is impossible that everyone will walk out being like, amazing, what a great time. There will be 10 people who will be like, this was a complete waste. And there's very little you can do about it.
Yeah, it's one of the only jobs in the world you know you can't finish or fully achieve.
Yeah.
When I read that and it said you were one of the first women to do comedy in India, is that because you've done both? So when you think of stand-up over here, is it performed the same way? Is there like a cultural difference over there that means that it's called comedy instead of stand-up? What's the...
So, you know, I think the rhythm of comedy is universal. That is what is actually most exciting to me, is that if you're genuinely funny, you could be doing it in a different language and someone will still find you funny. I've seen shows, I saw a comic do stand-up in German and I don't understand diddly squat of German, right? And there was something about this guy. He was just, I can't remember his name.
Henning Venning?
No, it wasn't as catchy as that. Okay. And there was something so sort of appealing about him, and he was so funny in just the way he spoke, the way he moved. And I could almost tell sort of the sentences and the cadence of the speaking almost tells you where a funny part is coming. And that to me is the most integral part of comedy, is that when someone's being funny, you can recognize it across languages and across cultures. Having said that, context is also the biggest thing that comedy is based in. Okay, so let me explain to you. In India, we have the comedy scene has been around for a while. We used to have these things called Hasya Kavi Sammelans, which was the funny poet societies, right? Where they would come together and sit together and sort of... It would be a baithak where there would be people sitting and then they would have a mic in the center and then there'd be an audience. And so people would get up one by one and go to the mic and read out their poetry. And it was very much based in sort of clever wordplay, witticisms and those kind of things, right? And then in 1991, we had what was called the Great Indian Laughter Challenge, where they finally bought stand-up comedy as it is practiced here, which a man and a mic. That happened in 1991 and this show exploded. Means like it was the highest rated show for, I think, about 5 years. You know, a slew of very, very popular comics that are still touring today came out of that. And that was in Hindi. English stand-up comedy with the person behind the mic happened as recently as 2009. And there used to be this one open mic run by a company that used to run open mics for everything once a week. It was an open mic that used to happen once a month for stand-up comedy. The next week is like slam poetry. The next week was like, you know, whatever, storytelling. So it was one of those things. And I remember going there for the first time. I remember watching a few people and wondering, like, I was like, oh, that's really nice. Like, it looks like I can do that. And so the next week I went, did a set to What Is Relative Silence and got 2 laughs. And I was like, I'm in. I don't even care. Like, 2 laughs in a 5-minute set, I'm okay. I'm going to do this and I'm going to try as hard as I possibly can. The way it is sort of practiced now is extremely similar to the way it is done here. Having said that, the industry behind stand-up comedy, I have not seen anything like it. Like, whoa, it blew my mind. The number of venues, the number of organizers, the number of promoters, the number of people in comedy. I think right now in India, we have about like a healthy like 70 people who have like 30-minute sets that could be rotated on a circuit. We have about 70 people, and that's not a whole lot for a country of 1 billion. And so that is, I mean, the difference is, of course, that audiences in India are, I think audiences in India still don't know what to expect when they come for a show. They're like, oh, what's it gonna be? Like, and there's that still that whole thing of like, you sit in the front row and someone's gonna call you a virgin and someone's gonna say your dick is tiny and, you know, that kind of thing still happens a lot. But audiences audiences in India still don't know what to expect. I think here, audiences are also more seasoned. Like, they'll even know, again, according to the cadence of what a comic is saying, they'll be able to laugh, like, provide you with a laugh. And I think that's the major difference. Just the age of the audiences right now.
Why was the language changed in 2009? What was the reason why it became in English?
It was just different people. I mean, so for example, I would not survive in the 1991 space. In that Great Indian Laughter Challenge, I would not be a part of it, because I think, I mean, I'm doing the exact opposite of what those comics were doing, which is, you know, sort of like poking fun at, I mean, even now the sort of mainstream comedy in India is mostly very sexist and very ageist. And I don't have that in me. I find that so boring, and I find that so cliched, and I wouldn't do it. And so that is not an industry that I would find space in. This one, the new one, and the way this has happened is that it's also been mostly kids from middle class or upper middle class backgrounds who are speaking in English to an audience that understands English. That has been, I think, a very unspoken to segment. Not too many people have had, you know, comedy happen in that. And that is why today Indian English comedy is accused of being classist, is accused of being sort of like, oh, y'all do it in English, so y'all think y'all are too smart, which is, and in India, English is a very sort of a very potent battlefield on which we are fighting our class wars. And so I think the stand-up comedy right now is just a very, very loaded, as it were, we used that word earlier, a very loaded space to be in right now.
It's like what you were saying again before we should have recorded some more, but it's like what you were saying before when you went to Edinburgh for a few days and you were like, it's just the whitest place on earth.
Yeah.
And you don't mean that as in Scottish people, you just mean everyone who's come up from London and Liverpool and whatever. And it's like, I think, I mean, there's a lot of talk of that being quite a middle-class playground, of that being, you know, white guys who can afford it can go up and do it. And anyone who isn't of that ilk might not see it as a place to go because they won't be discovered or whatever, but also can't afford that. So it's kind of, I think, but we only have that once a month necessarily. You have that all year round, it sounds like. And it doesn't sound like it's a pleasant time to be
in. Know, I'll tell you, actually, it is an amazing time to be in comedy because it is just the beginning, right? It is just the beginning. It is, of course, populated by people who speak English, but we also have, I think, a fledging Hindi scene. And it's the same thing that, you know, you were talking, I know that in your McPerrin episode where you were talking about how TV has sort of changed the way comedy. So with the 1991 revolution, with the Great Indian Laughter Challenge, and, you know, it had like 7 seasons, that was sort of TV comedy. Those were jokes about film stars and, you know, how she's so fat and unfuckable and, you know, they are so old and ugly, that kind of a thing. Whereas now the comedy that's coming up is genuinely, I think it comes attached with a point of view. It comes attached with an opinion, which generally was not there earlier. And it's happening in English as well as in Hindi. In Hindi, not as prominently. Like, I know for a fact that there are comics right now who are phenomenal in Hindi, who are also touring the exact same circuit that I am, who get standing ovations on a daily basis because Hindi is also our head language. So many English comics now, and I know this because I've done it as well, is where you switch between the two languages. So you do a setup in English where you are pointing out how absurd a thing is in a strange language, and then you give the punchline in Hindi. And immediately everyone knows, like everyone identifies almost instantly with the Hindi punchline, and the contrast of how ridiculous the thing is stands out even stronger because you said it in English. So there's a way to kind of navigate the minefield, as it were, and make it work for you, which I think a lot of comics right now are doing very, very well. And in touch wood, I really hope that more voices come out from the general public.
It sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if there is 70, let's just stick with that number for a ballpark figure, if there are 70 comedians doing that, professionally doing the runs in India, it sounds like you all can talk enough that you can be self-aware of audiences, that having to know that is a possibility. Whereas here, I think city by city, it would change so much that it's not kind of possible for us to go, because we might go, oh, Leeds audiences are like that or whatever. But in reality, it might just been they've done one gig in Leeds once in 5 years and that was it. Whereas it feels like you guys have a much stronger connection community-wise, but also a stronger awareness of culture and the way the audiences are perceiving what you're doing.
Oh, yeah. And you have to. You have to, because you know what? And I think that is a blessing and a curse at the same time, is that overt self-awareness. Again, because, and self-awareness gifts you context. And context is everything. India is a country where literally every 8 kilometers, the language changes. The sensibilities change. And so if you're standing, literally the jokes that work in Bombay, for example, which is the financial capital, the financial and entertainment capital of the country, to Delhi change. Like Delhi, which is the political capital, would prefer political jokes. They will laugh harder, clap harder. In Bombay, the Bollywood jokes, you know, work so much better. In Bangalore, you go down and they don't know what you're talking about if you say something about Bollywood. They might be aware of, like, they will be aware aware of politics, but with Bollywood in particular, they're like, we don't care, because literally Bangalore has also its own Hollywood industry. So India is a huge country. We could possibly spend the rest of our lives touring India alone, and we have 130 million people who understand English. A comic can possibly spend the rest of their lives touring India alone and be able to make a living off of it.
You said before there's like 70 comedians have maybe a 30-minute passable set for doing that, but then you've said that each city you'd kind of tailor it for that. So does that mean you've got 30 minutes on Bollywood, 30 minutes on politics, 30 minutes or do you mean you have a 30-minute set that you would be like, well, I'll open with my political stuff and end with it in this city because it's how would you deal with that?
So, you know, I touch wood, I have more than 30. I'm relieved. I am very, very sort of grateful to have more than 30 minutes, because I've had more than, I guess, 5 years of stage time now.
That's a headline spot, because here we do 20 minutes for a headline. So I'm assuming that
30 is the headline. Okay. Yeah, 30 is the headline.
Just for context, yeah.
Yeah, and so I think it's a general universal 30, right? And then you sort of tailor make it where, okay, if I have this Hindi punchline here, I won't use it when I'm in Bangalore. I will either say it in English and see if it has the same impact, or I will find something to substitute it with. And so I think there are 70, I think is the outer number, of people who have 30 minutes that could sort of work across clubs in all four metropolitan cities.
Right. When you say 70, what's the gender split in that?
There's about like... I'm going to give it a generous 10 women in comedy. And I'm not even going to say like stand-up comedians alone. I think stand-up comedians, there are about three of us who are doing it, like stand-up comedy.
As a job.
Yeah.
Right.
The rest are sort of like in sketch and in, you know, in improv and all that stuff. And so I'd say about 10. And that used to always irk me, because I was like, okay, out of, say, given an outer number of 70, if 10 are women, they all have to be some level of freaking amazing in order to survive. Whereas out of the 60 in the males, there will always be 30. Who suck, but their bros are keeping them alive and giving them spots and, you know, getting them stage time and putting them at the forefront of corporate shows. And so it always irked me that the percentage was unfairly divided in that aspect.
Playing devil's advocate, right, I just want to ask you a question, and I'm asking it just to find out your perspective on this. I don't necessarily believe what I'm about to say, if that makes sense. But
good things never start like this.
My question would be, if I was a female comedian, right, and I felt like that, I felt like I've got to be the best because otherwise I won't get spots. To me, that feels like it would be actually quite a positive driving thing coming out of a negative.
No, of course it's a positive driving thing, but it's not an even playing field.
Oh no,
it is not an even playing field.
Like I said,
it's
come out of a negative, definitely.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's kind of like saying like, oh look, she went through so much harassment and yet she is, you know, founded a school for disabled people. No, that's not it. That's really not it. That's not the point of it at all. The point of it is that the playing field is not even. And it really sort of also scares me, actually, the fact that so much of this industry is not really merit-based. It's all sort of relationship-based. It's all based on sort of how well you know that guy and how well that guy, you know, likes you. And I find that very unfair. I find that very unfair when the ultimate judge has to be the audience.
Are you talking about India now or England or both?
Just comedy in general.
Okay.
I've only come, and because I'll tell you the truth also, I entered comedy at a very, very fortunate time. Like, I think I was at the right place at the right time. And I managed to kind of hold on to it. Because at that point in time, it really was that there were so few comics that they just needed people to fill up time. Right? And I had the minutes. And so they put me on. But I know for a fact that if I was trying to get into comedy right now, in India even, I would possibly find it damn near impossible. I would not, it's all sort of that like handshaking, backslapping. I was like, I don't have the social skills for it. Like, I don't, you know, and that's actually Steve Martin has this great quote where he's like, you know, the idea is to just be so good that they can't ignore you. And it's better to spend time writing comedy than to be attending parties. Like, I think that's the focus of my life in general is to be just like, I want work. I don't want like a lifelong relationship. I just like, let's work together.
I think that it's becoming more of a meritocracy, especially over
here.
I don't know about India because I can't, obviously I've never been, I can't comment, but I think the internet has done that. I think the internet's leveled some of the playing field because you can find an audience now. I know you, I know you've got quite a lot of followers on Twitter and quite a lot on YouTube and stuff, and that is a privilege thing that you can tap into that nobody else has access to. You know what I mean? It's an audience that, you know, I'm sure there are, out of the 90 men in comedy there, maybe 60 of them don't have. Do you know what I mean? I don't know. I mean, I'm plucking numbers out of the air. But if I went with the statistics over here, there's a lot of comedians over here who would love to have an audience, but just haven't nurtured it and grown it in the same way that you seem to have done.
We also realize we have I have the general advantage of numbers, is that like the number of people that speak English in India is just higher than the population here.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
So, I mean, in terms of relativity, like, I think, touch wood, thank God, that there are these many people listening.
You also speak both languages, right?
Yes.
So you have a double advantage in the sense that there's a billion people in India. There's probably more now, but there's a...
1.3, actually.
Yeah, there's a few more than been born, right? It's that statistic. But there's 1.3 there. There's, I don't even know in England, but there's not a billion. Let's put it that way, a lot less. So yeah, but you could say that all you want, but you're limited to the rooms you're playing in terms of numbers you're going to be seen by.
Yeah.
And online, that obviously doesn't happen because it's as many people who can just find you.
Yeah.
So it's a case of there, if the content's good, that's a reflection on what your sort of following is. I don't want to say numbers because that's obviously a vanity figure more than anything, but it's indicative of you and you. And the fact that you're putting out quality and working hard on it, that you might, it might not seem like a meritocracy in real life, but online it feels like it
is. It's equalizing people. Though, having said that, just I'm amazed at the quality of... actually, may I say this? Because I might as well. This is a comedy podcast. I feel like translating stand-up to video, like a live stand-up performance to video, is a craft in itself.
Oh God, yeah.
And from the kind of rooms we have and the kind of work we've been doing, I mean, again, we don't even have those many rooms as that much of a constancy that we would be able to like nail down a room and then work different angles at making a video. And that's why every time you sort of film a video, it's an exercise in filmmaking, literally, is okay, how many cameras? Okay, 3 cameras set up, 1 camera set up. Okay, where does it cut now? Should it punch in at the punchline? Should it punch out? Is this a funny bit where where I'm moving my body? So let's give it a full, like those intricacies are sort of like, it requires an education in itself. And I think, I mean, that's what we're doing right now. All of us are just like rabidly watching, you know, stand-up specials and videos cut up of other comics just to kind of see how it works.
I think as long as you're putting effort in and it's clear that there has been a thought process behind what you've done, it's a case of you don't necessarily have to follow a format, because if there's too many specials that are similarly shot, I get really bored with it. So like Bill Burr's recent one where he did it in black and white, I really like the idea of that because I've not seen that done before. Do you know what I mean? And it's only one change, and it kind of added to it, or kind of removed from some jokes, but it was one of those things where you were like, I am aware that I'm watching this at home, because when I watch it on Netflix, I'm on my laptop, I'm really close to the screen, so I could, if I got really into it, deceive myself to be like, I'm not in the room, but I'm in the room.
You know
what I mean? But when you're watching it in black and white, you're sort of like, I'm not colorblind, I can, you know what I mean, I know that I'm watching a special wherever I'm watching it. So yeah, I know what you mean. And you talk about the fact that it's sort of, if he likes you, or if backhanded slap, you know, shake hands, and that didn't make any sense, but you get the sentence I was trying to come out with
yes.
That would you say that misogyny is greater here or there, or is it a boys, quote unquote, boys club?
Of course it is. And I mean, there is, of course, among the women also, there is the constant sort of the crab mentality, right, where you are sort of given the impression that I remember sort of being told this, is that whenever there would be another woman would enter comedy, I would have a ton of comics come up to me and be like, yeah, dude, your days are numbered. I was like, what do you mean my days are numbered? Just because someone did like a good show. I was like, this is not even, how does that happen? Is there space for only one woman? And that's not true. And I've actually gone out of my way to kind of, now I realize I've been around sort of longer than everybody else. So now I go out of my way to irritatingly be that person who's like, yeah, what up, ladies? Like, now I will overbond if that's what it takes, in order to make sure that no one ever feels like they can't occupy space. And I think that's what's very important right now, is making sure that all the women that are with me, or that are in the space together, is that we know that we can all occupy space in this industry. Is that there is not, it's not a competition of us against each other, but of everybody against each other. And if that means I have a special bond with all the ladies, hell yeah. And yeah, it does. I mean, you know, actually, so how it started out was, I was sort of, when I started doing comedy, It was with a bunch of guys, and I sort of used to hang around.
What year was that? When did that, you start?
This was in 2010.
Just to put context on it. So do you mind me asking, how old were you when you started?
I was 25.
25 when you started, 2010. So,
yeah.
So you've been doing it 6 years.
Yes.
And you've been full time for how many years of those?
Three.
Three. Okay. Sorry, can't remember what you're saying. Just so people have a context of what you're.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then I started with a bunch of guys, and I mean, I generally also have a very combative personality, which was why I am in, I think, in comedy, is because I like the idea of being able to confront something. You know, I sort of experienced things that I had nobody to turn around and ask if I was crazy or if I was validated in feeling like that. And I literally actually, so 1 year into this, I sort of had managed to distance myself from everybody because I was like, I can't trust anyone's intentions. And I started doing it on my own. And I remember for like almost 2 years, I was just, I was completely down and out because I was like, I don't know if I deserve this. I don't know if I'm funny enough because I now don't have the outside approval of guys. While they continued absolutely on with their boy gangs and all that stuff, I didn't have that. I think it's made me care lesser now. And now even I don't exist with the sort of support of anybody else. I've now run entire tours by myself, which I know that most of the comics that were starting out with me can't do anymore because now they're in gangs. So now sort of...
When you mean groups of male comedians or gangs? Yeah. Okay, right.
And so now I know that I can alone, like I organized a tour for myself last year in September, and I went to 11 cities in 13 days, and it was a sold out tour. And I mean, it wasn't massive rooms, it was rooms of like 100 and 300, and that was it.
I should just point out, if you want to just pause for a sec while comedians listening to this go, not massive, because I mean, to us that's still quite big.
Oh,
rooms.
Yeah? Yeah. And I managed to sell out this entire tour, and I did it pretty much all by myself. Like, it was me picking up the phone and making emailing people and hating every moment of it, of course, because I hate emails and phone calls. But I managed to do it by myself, and I think that was the first time I realized, I was like, I can stand on my own 2 feet and people find me funny and, you know, are willing to spend money and come and watch the show and then go away having had a good time. And to me, that was the biggest solace. And I was like, after this, I don't need validation from outside, from anywhere. I do not need any guy to tell me, oh, you're funny. I do not need any guy to say, you know, but Aditi, can you please come on our, you know, whatever, on our show. I did not want to be the token chick. We were doing a show, which was a Bollywood based show, and it was sort of like parody awards show. And the idea was that we would sort of parody, you know, the best supporting actress. And so one of the suggestions being bandied around was, let's just do tits. Let's just do, and I'm sitting in this room.
I'm like, great brainstorm, guys. Great brainstorm.
And yeah. I swear to God, right? And the thing that they were generally coming to the consensus to was, it would be hilarious if they just put a close up of all the tits of the girls who had been nominated. And I remember thinking, no, this is not, like, you've not worked at this. You've not worked at this, and this is not funny. And I remember, I can't even remember how I reacted exactly in that moment or in that space, because I was just so shocked. I was like, oh, are we going to do this? And am I going to have to stand backstage and watch my fellow comics do tits as a joke? While, like, it's that same thing of that wink, nudge jokes, which you're just saying the same nasty things, but with like a sort of smile and a glint in your eye. And that sort of didn't make sense to me. So I was really genuinely upset. And that was the time I realized I needed to like do this by myself, and I needed to kind of stand up on my own 2 feet, and it does, like, validation from outside didn't matter. And I went through that today as I watch women come into comedy. I think the system, there is so much of a larger support system. And of course, I think, I mean, I'm just also a very insecure person, which is why I do comedy in general. And so I think, yeah, things are changing, I guess.
I mean, I would have just said, you know, you guys put your balls out first and then we'll think about it. Like, you know, like, let's see you go on stage and do that, and then we'll have a renegotiation afterwards, because equality, why not? That's mental to me. Like, the fact they had a meeting for that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, like, so it was in a writing meeting, right? It was in a writing meeting. And they were like, oh my God, we'll do tits. We'll do just close up of tits. And I was like, what?
Tits out of context are not funny. Do you know what I mean?
No, but the idea was, it's so funny, right? Because supporting, and so because most Indian actresses, I didn't even get that. And most Indian actresses are merely set pieces. So the supporting actress would just be a pair of tits to literally a set piece. And so how hilarious would that be?
Do you know what drives me mad in comedy in general? Is people that say it's just a joke, right? Because that should not be your defense. It should be implicit in the joke that it's a joke, so you shouldn't have to say it. And second of all, the people that say, oh, I'll just say it and apologize later if I have to. And it's like, do you know that whole get permission later rather than consent, that kind of thing? And you're like, well, then you shouldn't be saying it, because you obviously, again, it's not a joke.
Yeah. Especially if you were saying, I'll get permission later, which means that there was permission required to say the damn thing.
Yeah.
You know, and that is also one constant, this thing that we are, like, we've had a couple of things happen where our law enforcement services have taken notice of what is happening in stand-up comedy. And now there's this constant battlefield of freedom of expression. expression, and you know, you are allowed to make a joke. And I do. I'm all for freedom of expression. I am all for being able to make a joke, right? But that cannot mean that you go around talking absolute garbage, because then you are not doing your job, my friend. If you've managed to offend someone, you have not done your job. Your job is to be clever and funny.
Well, I mean, I know you don't necessarily have to be clever to be funny, but I saw someone the other day who was not being clever and they were being very funny.
I know that, I agree. But I'm saying, I say in general, especially if you're dealing with something that is so sensitive that it might incense people, is that you have got to then be so smart about it that you manage to make your point and make people laugh. That's what it is.
I find that the hardest part of this job is that if I have something that is an actual subject I want to make it. So like, I had a joke in my last show and it was a long build. It was about how I hate International Women's Day. And the reason for that is because you shouldn't need a day. I basically said that you get the same number of days a year as pancakes, and that drives me insane. And I don't know if you have pancake day over there, but the joke ends on me saying that I hate feminist comedians who come up, like middle class white comedians who come up on stage now and say stupid things like women are equal, they can do everything as well as men, because it's not true. Like, historically, there's one thing women can't do as well as men, and that is oppress a gender, right? Yeah,
that's funny.
Exactly right. But I had a woman come up to me in Brighton when I was doing previews, and she said, like, do you know, I found that quite offensive as a joke. And I was like, but I'm saying you're really good at not being shit. Why is that offensive? Like, where is that offensive? And it was one of those things that I was not going to apologize for, because I felt like I was so on the right side of that. Yeah. And she didn't back it up. Like, if she'd backed it up and said, this is why that's offensive, I might have apologized. But I don't feel like you should have caveat an apology into a joke, because then you shouldn't be saying it.
Yeah. I think that's exactly it. I really do believe why I love this job so incredibly much is because it, you know, beyond 20 minutes, actually, who you really are starts showing on stage. What you really believe starts showing on stage. It's literally like your sleeve slips off and your bra strap is showing, my friend. And you know what? You gotta, like,
You know me so well.
And it's sort of, it's one of those things where I don't know, I think that I'm so confident of what side I am on, and I am so confident of my intentions, that I know I will defend to the death what I say on stage. And I think that is my biggest sort of solace, is that I'm not lying and I am not saying anything that would physically harm someone. And so I will do this job with my 100% conviction, and I will not be banding about random apologies and stuff like that, because this is it. This is my worldview. And if you have laughed in that moment, you are complicit, by the way. If you have laughed, because you laugh for two reasons, right, at a joke. One is, oh my God, I never thought of it that way. And oh my God, I know exactly what she's talking about. And so if you laughed, my friend, at that moment, there was a level of identification with that. So
let's not pretend you're a moral arbiter after laugh.
And you know what? I'll be honest also. I feel like now everyone is getting so offended at comedians' jokes and all. I'm like, these are jokes. Okay. If you found it offensive, then I didn't do my job of making it funny. For that, I will apologize. But I cannot apologize for you being hurt or whatever. That you keep you nurse your hurt for yourself.
Yeah. The thing I cannot, and I've started eliminating people from my life who do not take responsibility for all of their thoughts, feelings, and emotions and actions, because it's you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I get that you can't control your feelings, like people, but you can control your reaction to them. And if you're not working on that, I don't have time for you. Because if you turn around to me and go, I'm offended, it's like, great, well, you go and deal with that. Because it's in you. No, because it's in you. It's
You know, there's that CK joke. You're a big fan of Louis CK. And there's that CK joke where you're like, where he's like, people are like, we can't legalize gay marriage because what will I tell my children?
Yeah,
it's like, you're shitty children. You tell them.
Don't make it my problem. Well, I've got a joke. I still can't make this funny. It's driving me mad. But it's about, I used to be really fat, and I trying to write a joke about how I don't think you can fat shame someone, because yes, you've been a dick about it, but it's in them that their shame is there. Do you know what I mean? So it's your emotion that's coming out there, and if you're taking responsibility for your reaction, because I'm fine with my body shape now, and I would probably be fine if I got fatter again, because I'm sort of comfortable with
who
that.
You are.
Yeah, with who I am. But when I wasn't, it was because I was eating because I wasn't comfortable with who I was.
Yeah.
And so they were poking a symptom of a bigger thing, and it was my fault for not dealing with that, not theirs.
No, you know what, I'll tell you the truth. We also live in a world where these symptoms are taken to proportions that are genuinely sort of like, that's why I think I do believe in reining it in unless you are really making an amazing point.
Yeah.
And we do live in a world where we now know concepts like victim blaming. We are, I mean, touch wood, it's so great to be living in a world where these are cliches and these are tropes that we are aware of and we can avoid.
I would never victim blame someone if I was consciously aware of who, but the thing is, I'm very self-aware in general, and I would I would call myself a relatively intelligent person. And also I would say that when I write a joke, I make sure that I am the victim in that joke, or I'm always punching upwards.
Yeah.
Because even with that joke I was telling you before, the stalking someone online, that one, right? I feel like I'm punching upwards with that because I'm the idiot who doesn't understand language in that joke. I'm not someone taking fun of stalker. I'm not taking the side of a stalker. Do you know what I mean? And it takes forever to do that. But I think people don't do that in general in life. We do that more in comedy because we have to go, we will have to take accountability for this thing we're going to say.
We also have more time. We also have...
You might. No, you don't do your admin.
We just have more time. I think that's a part of our job is to be self-aware and irritatingly so.
I think that everyone is doing comedy for one wrong reason. And until I know what that reason is, I don't know if I can be around them. Because I've realized there are three reasons why I won't be friends with a comedian if I think it's their reason for doing it. One, if it's a shortcut to like acting work or presenting, fuck off. Two, if you're just trying to pull the whole fucking time, if you're doing it like impress girls or whatever, I'm like,
I am impressed if there is somebody doing this job to impress girls. Wow. I'm impressed.
I have a begrudging level of respect in the sense that how are you doing this? Because no girl has ever thought, yeah, he talks about his ex a lot. I'd love to have him out on a date. You know what I mean? Like, but I suppose it's I'm deflecting people for a defense mechanism, whatever, right? And the third one is if they're just having a midlife crisis. If they're just, you know what I mean? If they've had like a divorce and they're going, oh, I was always told I was the funny guy in the office. You're like, you stay in the office and be funny.
The ones who use it as therapy, which I do as well.
No, but I don't think you do. I hate people that say comedy is therapy. I think once you're over the thing, it can be therapeutic to talk about it. But I don't think you can actually use comedy as therapy if you haven't got over it.
Oh, yeah, because it requires a lot of work. Therapy doesn't require work. Like therapy, you have to just show up and talk. And comedy, you have to like...
Therapy definitely like required a lot of work.
Oh, did it? Yeah. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
But I think it's like being in front of the most judgmental therapist in the world. Like, and you have
you've
to
got mine.
Well.
I have a bigger notepad than she does. No, I get what you mean. I just think you can't make something effectively as funny, the funniest it can be if you're not over it. So as a result.
Distance plus time. You know, that's sort of tragedy plus time. Sorry, that's what I meant.
Tragedy plus time.
I was doing like some speed formulas.
Well, no, I've added to
distance
that.
Distance plus time.
Equals MC squared shit. I've changed that formula in my head. It's so it used to be comedy is tragedy plus time.
Yes.
Right, but I would say it's comedy plus time plus joke equals comedy. Do you know what I mean?
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Because otherwise you just got a great story. Like, you know what I mean? It's like don't just wait a year and then go, oh, I could talk about my uncle now.
No. If you're gonna talk about your uncle, there have to be like solid punchlines in there about.
Yeah, exactly.
What were we talking about before?
I was gonna ask you because you said that you'd got booked a couple of times as like a token performer on a bill.
Yeah.
And I wondered is this your first time over here?
This is my fourth time.
Fourth time here. Do you find first of all, do you find that still happens in India? And do you find that has ever happened over here? Because over here, and again, this is a devil's advocate point in my head. Over there, you would be a token woman. Over here, you'd be a token Indian woman. So as a result, you could be booked, and I'm not saying you have been, but you could be booked for two reasons to make that club set up a bit more diverse.
The first three times that I came here, I didn't come to do clubs. I came to do the BBC Asian Network, and so that was sort of...
quite pigeonholed.
That, I guess, was in itself a pretty specialized requirement. Having said that, I'm also just damn good. Like, I would hate to be that person who's like, you know, I think, yeah, of course, my femininity got me. So, like, I know for a fact that they went through the other comics, looked at them, and then chose me. So it's not like I was token when I was coming here. Having said that, in India, I, by the way, gain and lose a lot of work because of my vagina. And that is primarily because there are, like, places, bookers that would not book me because they'd be like, listen, it's a boys' college. They'll eat you up.
Would you want to do that gig, though? Would you be like, I want that challenge?
I'll do it.
Because there are some people...
And you know what? Here's the thing. I want the choice. I want the choice to say no. I want the choice to say I may not be comfortable. I want the choice to say, actually, hell yeah, let's go for it.
So do you think it's patronizing they would assume that you wouldn't do well at that gig? Or do you think it's they know their audience well and it's annoying to you not getting a choice?
They've not given me a choice. I don't even care if it's patronizing or if it's... They've not given me a choice. And that is what is irritating to me. There have been times when I have been too expensive to take along as a person of a group of comics because I would require my own room. And that is sort of the male comics can share rooms.
Oh, so you just mean you'd want a dressing room or do you...
No, room as in like, you know, if we're traveling, right? We're traveling in groups. And so in the hotel, I would require my own single room. For the first 2 years of my career, I spent a lot of time, you know, traveling with groups, but I was always sort of given my own room. And everyone was like, wow, how lucky you are. And all I was like, this is not luck. This is, by the way, not luck because I know I'm losing work for the very same reason that y'all think I'm very lucky. So I don't know about patronizing and I don't know about anything else. I just want to have the choice.
So your work on the BBC Asian Network over here, did that help set you up for this trip? Or was that literally just you were offered work and you thought, great, it's a great... I assume BBC Asia airs over there, doesn't it? Or is it...
No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
So you were aware of the BBC?
Oh, yeah. As a kid, actually, that's kind of what I wanted to do. Like, I was always like, you know, I want to grow up and become a journalist on the BBC. And when I first got contacted by them, I nearly fainted. I was like, what?
What happened? They just email?
Just emailed. Okay. And I was pretty blown and really excited. And it was at that point, actually, also, I was like, this is something that's being offered to me. Like, this is an opportunity that's being offered to me. And I think it was also the token, this thing, right? Because we had done, like, stand-up comedy in India is still a relatively new thing. And I've realized also, in India also, newspapers, the moment they run out of actual content, they'll call two comedians and say, hello, can you tell us your opinion on XYZ? And then they'll shove it into a column or they'll make you write a column or something like that, right? And so when I got the email, I was just really excited and I went around telling everybody. And then I guess I did well enough that they called me back the second time. And then I did well enough that they called me back the third time. And then I did well enough that, you know, I got approached by BBC Radio 4, which is, I reckon, a bigger channel than BBC Asian Network, to do the show that I just recorded. And so I don't want to take away. Like, I don't know, I would love to be like self-deprecating, but I've realized people don't get self-deprecation. Like, people don't get that.
Over here we do. It's like a big thing.
yeah, you know, and yes, that is true. I love how I was watching this show called The Big School. It's a BBC show, and it was so funny, but I enjoy how much the English call out sort of that saturnine fake. I just love that. I love watching somebody like take down, like Stuart Lee is my favorite. I love watching Stuart Lee dedicate like 4 minutes of his special to hating on Michael McIntyre. I'm like, this is so funny. What a waste of your time, Stuart Lee. But this is so funny.
Yeah. I think, again, it's the punching up thing. He's got this outsider, even globally though, but he's got an outsider persona.
Yeah.
I mean, he's very clever in the way he's engineered that, because even when he had a TV show, you could ask 10 people on the street and maybe four of them would know instead of three. And he's never made himself, because he could easily have made himself bigger than he is right now.
Yeah,
and yet he's sort of like, but he couldn't have a go at Dara O'Brien or McIntyre or whoever he wants to have a go at if he was bigger, because it would be like...
He would be them.
Yeah.
You know, and so this is also one thing, right? In India, what I noticed was, I think I literally am one of the very few people that still stayed a stand-up comedian from the time that we started 5 years ago, because I just didn't become a celebrity. At no point in time was I at a YouTube fan fest where someone was screaming my name, because I also wouldn't know what to say. I would just collapse into a puddle and be like, this is so embarrassing. The problem with comedians in India, at least my generation of comics in India, was that they became celebrities. And as a comic, you cannot be the celebrity. You have to be at the back of the class, pointing at the celebrity and showing everyone else how funny that celebrity is. You can't be the celebrity, you can't be the celebrity, because otherwise you sort of are instantly too high in the power structure to be able to kind of comment on anything else. And that I think is one, I'm overtly insistent. That's actually, which is why I was being managed by an MCN, and they said you should go for YouTube Fan Fest, you know, it'll be amazing, and you know, your fans want to meet you. And I was like, are you kidding me? This is so embarrassing. Like, I wouldn't know what to say. I really wouldn't know what to say. That's really not who I am. Like, I'm not like, I'll go there with like thousands of screaming people and I'll be like, yeah, swag, what up? Like, I don't want you hanging on to my every word if I've not written it carefully, if I've not curated it to the best of my skills and knowledge and ability and time availability. I do not sort of identify with the
celebrity culture.
One, that, because and you know what, I'll be honest, because my mum also is the executive producer of what is India's Law and Order, which is this show called CID, which is comically bad, but it's very, very popular. And I think my mother taught me very early on in the game that nobody wants to be friends with a celebrity. People will work with you if they like who you are and if you're a pleasant person to be around. The moment you start demanding flowers in your vanity van and want like 6 doves to sit on top of your head, nobody's gonna like you, sorry. And I think to me that I want to ensure, I tend to live long. I intend to live for a substantial amount of time and I intend to stay in this career, which is why I would prefer to be human instead of godlike or celebrity-like for as long as I can, because I just want to keep getting consistent work. I do not want to be a superstar. I want to be a worker.
But you can be a celebrity and not make demands like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, you can. Of course you can.
Yeah.
But the culture in India, which sort of elevates you to celebrity status, requires you to kind of be that.
Okay.
Requires you to kind of, because people won't give you importance unless you demand that, na ki, ha, I want 7 white towels with 1 drop of blood from an Egyptian virgin smeared into the left-hand side corner of each towel.
That's not that demand. I mean, that's...
I mean, you know.
Sorry, we'll get them for you in a minute. That's a... I get what you're saying. I mean, I love what I'm doing right now in the terms of building a relationship with my audience. I do not want fame in any way, shape or form, but I know that that's a byproduct of the industry that going into.
And so that's what is irritating, is when people work towards the fame as opposed to the jokes.
Yes, that's the thing.
Just work towards everything else except the jokes. What is wrong with you?
That's the biggest problem in our industry over here, is that so the biggest problem in our industry, to nail it down, after doing this for 2 years now, I can tell you exactly why it's gone bad. There are too many young comedians who are marketable in other areas that come in, who maybe don't even write their own material, get picked up by a big agent who have control of the media, put them into a position where they can go, right, well, they could be a presenter, let's try them there. If they're not a presenter, let's put them on radio. If they're not a presenter, that kind of thing. They become a celebrity. Sycophant fans will buy tickets to anything they do because that's what celebrity culture is now. And as a result, they believe their own hype because they're never given any feedback or construction or anything like that. And as a result, they've got a career out of it, which is going to be a cash cow for the agent and for themselves. And they don't know what they're doing outside of it, so they stay with the agent.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you've got the issue in that people see that, and because there's a celebrity culture in that so many young people now don't know what else they want to do with their lives and they want it to be their thing. I'm not saying all, by the way. I'm not saying all young people. There is a portion of people who will do anything for fame. There was a rapper on YouTube who shot himself in the face to try and get... Yeah, did you see that?
No, I didn't.
He shot himself through the mouth and put it up online as a promotional stunt for his new single. And it was like, how bad do you want attention for your work instead of working on the work? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and that is why. And honestly, that's what I'm telling you, because these things are also very easy distractions.
Yeah.
It is very easy. Now I know there are some like groups or these comics and all who will literally poop in a bowl for 35 minutes and people will buy 3,000 rupee tickets for it, because why not? Because you're getting to see them, they're real, you get to touch them eventually. I don't want that. I literally don't want you to spend 3,000 bucks. I want you to come to a show and then be so blown and be so happy that you spent that 500 bucks.
So can you put 500 bucks into context? Because over here, that's a lot of money.
500 bucks is, I guess, like 10, 12 pounds.
Okay, cool. Sorry, because 500 pounds over here is a lot.
I mean like 10, 12 pounds. Yeah. I want to give you your 10, 12 pounds worth multiplied by 500.
Yeah.
For the lack of a better word.
Yeah.
In order to kind of, like, I guess I'm also just a complete whore for the live element.
Yeah.
It's like writing in the sky, right? You have to be there to experience it, to see that energy, to see the way people are laughing, to sort of see the comics sweating. I think it's all the magic of of being live, which I think I hold way more sacrosanct than putting up a video on YouTube.
Yeah, I mean, I still do the online content because I know that the only way I'm going to get found is that right now.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, especially as I'm not shunning the industry, but I'm far more interested in finding out what they do and then running away and doing it. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to be a part of the cog machine that already exists over here. Yeah. Like you said, the celebrity culture cog machine or the skipping steps machine just for quick bucks.
You know, and I'll tell you.
And that's,
No, that's it. Because, and I'll tell you the truth, man, because you're never going to be then. People are going to get bored of you.
Yeah, but there's always someone new they can market it to. That's the problem, is that they can say they won this award, they sold out this thing.
Oh, that's that success breeds success concept, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's an endless spiral. And if they push you hard enough at the start, they've already got the momentum that it's not a problem.
Though, frankly, again, you know, I've also realized, okay. Like, I mean, I don't sort of resent anybody's success, and I think good for them if they've figured it out by putting out some mediocre stuff and, you know, charging people to touch them or to take a photograph with them or whatever. Great for them. I don't know if I want to do that. I think too low of myself and simultaneously too highly of myself to be able to do that.
All I want is to be well known enough that my constructive feedback is taken like as a serious point of criticism and not jealousy. Do you know what I mean? Like, because you know when you say to someone, like if I said to someone, oh yeah, I can't believe you're on this cycle of becoming a sort of that kind of thing. You can easily look like the jaded little comedian who's not doing that if you're not well known enough. I just want to get to a stage where they have to take it as a point that I genuinely mean it and not I'm the little guy who didn't get that option. So I'm dicking off at your...
Well, you know what? I want to get to a point where I can, every time I have an hour ready, I can sell the tickets to the show. That's it.
Yeah,
I don't even want anything else. I don't want your respect. I don't want your...
Yeah.
I just want to sell enough tickets that people will come and listen to me when I'm ready to be able to talk and tell, make jokes. That's it. Everything else that comes is a plus.
That's literally all I want as well. And but you seem to, I mean, you like you said, you've got the advantage of numbers on your side in terms of both language barriers, but also the number of people in your country.
Yeah.
You, like you said, this circuit is a massively bigger one than yours. How many clubs would you say are in those four metropolitan cities that you mentioned earlier?
So we have actually one dedicated comedy club that recently branched off into a second one.
Right.
So we have two. The entire country. And the others is just sort of like bars and pubs and smaller clubs that like literally like this is where there's a band one night of the week, there's something else the other night of the week, the third night of the week there's comedy and then, you know, something else. That sort of is happening a lot as well. I've seen turnover. I've seen like violent turnover in the past 5 years as well of those very venues. Also venue owners in Bombay or in not only in Bombay because that's a lie, but all over the country, I think want to see comedy. Comedy is one of those things that you have to work on, right? Is if you're doing one night a week, it has to take time even for the audience to catch up with what's going on. I don't think most venue owners allow that breathing room for a thing to develop long enough. They like literally four nights in, they're like, "Arey, nobody came. Chalo, cancel." That's kind of short-sighted in my opinion. But I mean, I don't run a club, luckily. So I literally, my opinion doesn't matter.
Oh, no, it does actually. Because what I've realized recently is clubs can't exist without comedians. We can exist without clubs.
That's true, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I could book this room at the camp. I mean, I couldn't, they've got dedication over it, but I could book a room and put on a gig.
Yeah.
And yes, I wouldn't be as good at promoting it, but like we said before, my take on it is I want to do things right first time so I don't have to do them again. So the whole email thing. Yeah, so the whole emailing thing for me, the mailing list is I'm more than happy to ask for an email address now so that I don't have to make effort as much later down the line. So if I do that long enough, I don't need a club. I'd still love to do clubs. I'm really happy to do them and I love doing clubs. But like your opinion does matter because like I said, they can't exist without you. So you can't discount your voice in that conversation for definite.
I mean, you know, again, I don't know. It's that very thing where you can't sort of then start thinking that your shit don't stank.
No, but you have a voice in it.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Okay. And so given the way that circuit is constructed, how did you find building an audience? Like, how was that as a process for you?
You know, I've done my special that for six people once. I did in a 300-seater, I did my special for six people. And I'll tell you this. Okay, so no, let me give you context, right? So I was ready with my special in the end of 2014.
That was your first hour, yeah?
Yes,
okay.
That was my first hour. And I was ready with it at the end of 2014. And I said, so I went to the club that was called Canvas Laugh Factory at that point. So I went to them and I said, listen, can you please give me dates?
So can I ask, based on that, just so again, for context for people, is it an English speaking special and it was an English speaking club?
Yes, okay. It was one of the English speaking, it was the English speaking club. So I went to them, I said, can you give me dates? And they said, of course. And they gave me dates and I was given one date a month and I was given dates for 3 months. So I was given three dates. And I was like, you know, I'm really excited and I sort of started pushing it on Twitter and Facebook and all these things, right?
How big was your social following at that point?
Like, I mean,
I had an account.
Like, I don't know. Okay, I guess like 21,000 people.
That's quite a lot, but yes, okay.
But again, you know, it's a numbers game, yeah. Right? And so, but the thing is, again, how many of those translate to people coming to watch you? So I remember the second date that I was doing for that show, the show before mine. And so there was an 8:30 show and there was a 10:30 show. The show before mine was this show with incredibly super popular comic and another incredibly super popular comic. There were two of them on this show and the house was packed, okay, and everyone was laughing and it was great. And then my show was after that, and then the management came and they were like, Aditi, we've sold 6 tickets. And I was like, okay, let's do the show for 6 people. And so before the end of the first the 8:30 show, I asked the comic, I said, can you possibly just announce if people want to stay back for free, they can stay back for free, because I'd rather have, say, 4 more people just to kind of have life in the room. And so this guy's like, and he was very, very generous, and he said, yeah, of course. And so he went and announced, you know, at the end of his show, he said, okay guys, you know, after this is Aditi Mittal's thing, they won't let me say, and you know, if you want to stay back, please, you know, it's compliments of the venue, etc., etc., etc. I guess about 22 people and like, you know, ended up at the show. And I did the show. And it went as a show with 22 people in a 300-seater would go. I was having a blast. I was like, I had people. I wanted to entertain them. So I was like, kar lo yaar, just do it. So now I've done it. And then I go back. And then on Facebook, one of the people that had been at both the shows put up a message on Facebook saying, you know, we came for show X, that we came for the 8:30 show, and we were so deeply disappointed that we decided to stay back for the 10:30 just to make up for the money we spent. Because we were like, we want to extract value out of this. And they're like, we wish we had come for the 10:30 directly. And that, I think, is the only way that I've known, is just to work as hard as I possibly can.
As Rihanna says.
to quote Rihanna, is...
Let's bring my homegirl into this.
So just...
I hate that song.
Just work myself. I hate all Rihanna songs. Ella, I'm
going to
punch
really?
The umbrella.
Yeah.
Punch the umbrella. So I think that's the only way I've known, is to just sort of keep working. And again, I think I've been very lucky in those aspects where people, like the tour that I did in September last year, I had people come up to me and just say stuff like, you know what, whatever you're doing, just keep at it. Don't ever stop. And that to me means an infinite more than, you know, someone like handing me something gigantic on a platter, because that's the stuff that keeps me... I'll literally walk around with a backpack for the rest of my life if that's what it takes. I think I've dedicated my life to this. I think I'm a little married to comedy and the idea of wanting to make people laugh, even if it's in a room with 3 people or 22 people. That doesn't matter to me.
So that tour, I assume you organised all that yourself?
Yes, just entirely by myself.
Have you carried that on, or now you got an agent now? Are you with...
Yeah, I'm with management. I mean, again, one of those things that... I was so apprehensive at first. I was like, oh my God, I don't want to be one of those people that's like packaged off and so off into these like weird commercial things. Then I realized nobody even wants me for weird commercial things, which is great by me actually. But again, then the opportunities that come by are these kind, where you get invited to come and write a show for the BBC.
Or do an award-winning podcast.
Or do an award-winning podcast with
not
Simon.
Not mine, not this one. Isn't award-winning, but I am sure you'll get invited to see them. No, but that came out when you didn't have management, didn't it?
Yeah, and actually, no. Yeah, I'll be honest with you. All the work has come without the management.
Yeah.
I think we were discussing this before we started recording, is how much I hate the emails and the following up. And because also, this is barely an industry in India, right? This is barely an industry and it's highly unregulated. So we have a ton of, like, I know there are gigs that I've not been, that I did 4 and 3 and 2 years ago that I've not been paid for yet. And so you need someone there, like making the calls and being like, where is the check? Send the money. Where is the check? Send the money. Where is the check? Send the money. And I think that is what, because, and that would take up, like, honestly, I don't want to wake up in the morning and then have to fight with someone to get money that I earned. Yeah.
So, and I don't want to be too blunt about it. Well, no, why not? we're friends now. So that meeting with that agent, you were kind of like, I'm doing this all myself. I don't like emails. I don't like phone calls. I don't like chasing money. Will you just do that? Or was it more, they were like, we want to sell, like you said, was it, we want to not package you off, but we want to market you in this way? Or I mean, what was that meeting like?
I think actually, I'm really lucky because the person who I am being managed by right now is someone who is actually someone that I trust implicitly and I genuinely love as a person. And so when I went to them, I was performing at a Miss India. I was performing at a Miss India gig, right? So these are the beauty contests or whatever.
Wow.
So I was performing there and...
Were you taking part in the thing or were you just...
No, please, okay. Jeez, look at me.
Okay, first of all, I do not know what the beauty standards are over in India. And second of all, I do not want to stereotype. So don't go there. Could be anything right now.
So I was an act. And so I was doing this in between rounds, like while the girls were getting changed from their bikinis into like their gowns or whatever. So they sort of brought me on
stage.
So you
didn't need your own room for this gig. Well, that's
So then I end up sort of, and I'm doing the 10-minute slot. And then the person who was organizing the gig, who did the entire show, came up to me and he was like, you know, Aditi, this was awesome and you're so fun. And, you know, who's managing you right now? And I was like, me? He's like, okay. And then I sort of had this, I literally had a hash out with him. I said, listen, I'm not comfortable with the idea of being packaged off and sold, and I'm very, very particular about the things that I am sort of, even corporate shows, right? In India, I've had those experiences where the organizer would call and say, send me a picture. We want specifically a female comedian, send me a picture. I'm like, what do you do with picture? I can understand if you're saying, send me your joke, send me a video or whatever. And send me a picture. And then what dress are you wearing? And then it makes you realize that there is also that whole subculture of, we want someone attractive to just come and be mostly eye candy. And I don't fall into the category of eye candy, and I really actually I'm vehemently opposed to that idea. And so I sort of told him everything, you know, there are small things, like most sort of these, a lot of these corporate gigs or whatever, they'll have, you know, an open bar, and then at open bars there would be the sort of, you know, the executives who would get very vocal and very drunk, and then because you're a woman and you're doing comedy and you're standing up there on stage and saying something funny, is that they would think that you are just a free-for-all and would treat you as such. And I've had gigs where some guy was just like trying to grab my hand and make me sit on his lap and stuff like that. And I told Neil everything. I told him, like, I was like, you know, post 10 o'clock, if there is any place that has a show that is starting, whatever, if the function is starting at 7 and they have an open bar, I'm not going up on stage 3 hours after the bar has been open, because I know that there is a certain pack mentality that happens in these corporate shows with, you know, people just getting overconfident and wanting to paw everything that moves. And so I said stuff like this to Neil, and he was so understanding. And so sort of accommodating, which is why I even signed up in the first place. And even now, you know, everything I do, he's sort of in on it. And him and Meenal, so it's called House of Talent, and him and Meenal have just been my backbone in terms of just keeping me afloat and keeping me, I guess, administratively above the water in terms of handling my gigs and in terms of even setting a market value. Because I'll tell you the truth also, people will not want to hire you for a gig for X rupees if you're the one calling to negotiate your own rates. If you have a manager, then it's, oh, this person is important enough that they have a manager.
I don't want to make everything gendered, because that's not like a thing I'm comfortable doing. But is that a gendered thing, or is that just every comedian over there?
That's a celebrity culture thing. Okay. It's a celebrity culture thing where, you know, you're supposed to be unavailable and sort of, oh, so cool that you won't like have a direct conversation with anyone. That sort of...
No, I wondered if it was maybe a class or a caste or some sort of system where it's like a woman ringing up saying, I'm worth this. It could...
You know how bad, like, I couldn't, first of all, because I'm also middle class and I'm also a woman, those two things used to make me most uncomfortable. I would say no to gigs outright because I used to almost feel embarrassed to tell them my rate, how much I was charging. Also, I used to be like, no, I'll message you, I'll email you, because I would not be able to say it on a phone call. And having someone there has really sort of changed the game entirely. Like, now I have a book and a calendar, and she takes care of it. Like, Meenal takes care of it. You know, Neil is sort of aware of, he's like, you know, they'll be like, okay, Aditi would not be comfortable going into this environment, so from our end, just say sorry. She will not be able to make it. And that kind of thing, it's bad cop, good cop, right? And so if someone is there playing bad cop for you, it's just much easier. And I like being good cop a lot.
Yeah, that makes sense. It sounds like a very healthy relationship you have with that agent.
Yeah.
And is it Mick represents you over here then, or is it a case of they represent?
You know, I'm having a meeting with Natalie on Monday, so I'll know then.
I was just wondering how it worked when you come over here, because have they arranged this trip then, essentially?
No. Oh, this one was done by BBC and my producer, Ed Morris. He contacted me a year ago to do something called the Now Show. He was doing a pilot for them, and he called me and he said, would you like to perform? And I said, yeah. And so I did this performance over Skype. And since then, you know, we kept in touch. I love Ed because I'm so blown by this guy. His previous show was a comic who was talking about his son that he adopted, who is autistic. And Ed is telling me this like 3 days ago. He's like, yo, so I'll be honest, I've had to be that guy who is sitting there with three comics who are like talking about their personal tragedies on stage. And I've had to be that guy who who's like, yeah, yeah, that's really sad, but where's the joke? I was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And I've sort of realized the value of, actually I've seen the function of a producer for the first time in my life. Because before that, sort of comedy also is one of the very purest art forms, is where you write, direct, and then execute all by yourself. And to have someone there as a second voice or a second set of eyes looking at you from the outside, I did not realize it could sort of make things so awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And if we were to look at pre-agent and now,
mm-hmm.
what if you had like a pie chart of how split your time and how that translated into you being a full-time? Because a lot of people define being full-time differently. Because some people, it's just they want to gig all the time. Some people, they want to have like writing work and gigging. I mean, if you were to break down the pie chart of where you stay afloat financially as well as in your own time, how would that look to someone who obviously has no idea?
You know, and so I'll be honest, it changed drastically. Because before that, and I'm not proud to admit it, because before that, I was literally living month to month. I was running my own house. Me and my dad were living together. And I was running the house entirely with my earnings. But with that, literally with that sort of, because financial responsibility also, or knowledge, frankly, is not something that I was particularly interested in and is not particularly insisted upon. So I was just sort of living month to month. Oh, rent money is here. Oh, enough, you know, to like eat out and party or whatever is here. That's it. And with the way, sort of, now that I've had management and now that I've had people invested in me as a person, which then has led them to be invested in me as a comic, has changed drastic. Like, I've been doing taxes on time, which is crazy. I've been, and I think it's also given me more time to dedicate to things that I'm truly passionate about, which was something that I didn't have time for earlier because I was doing horrible things like calling people and being like, where's my money? Where's my money? Can I please have my money? Can you please send the money? Have you sent the money? Can you send me a screenshot of the money that you've transferred? Oh, 7 days later when the screenshot has not happened or the money has not come, then I'm like, oh, can you just send a check anyway? You end up ruining a relationship also like that. And so, I mean, I've been able to have more consistent relationships with people who would hire me for comedy because it's just been clean, dry and professional, which earlier was not the case. I think it's changed drastically since I managed to get. And I think that's one of the things. I think it's very important that when you are doing comedy or when someone's taking you on as a client, as a comic, that they should know you. They should know what you want to do, what you are passionate about. And like, for example, I'm the only comic he represents. I'm literally the only comic out of the, 70. I'm the only one he represents because he's like, Aditi, I want to focus on you. I want to make sure he's got one comic, one musician, one, that kind of thing. But he's like, I want to focus on you. I don't want key when somebody calls, then I'll be like, oh yeah. Oh, what is your budget? Okay, in that budget, I have 9 people. No, I don't want to do that. And that has kind of built an implicit trust in me that I never imagined I would have professionally with anybody else, especially being the crazy paranoid comic that I am. Like,
yeah, no, I understand. I was thinking about this the other day, whether, because I don't really want an agent right now. I'm kind of comfortable with what I do and I'm happy with it.
Yeah.
And I think it's a trust issue more than anything.
Yeah.
Like bringing someone, I've got a lot of trust issues anyway, but bringing someone into this business I'm building essentially.
Yeah.
Is it would take too much, they would have to show so much of a commitment to what I'm doing that I've not seen that yet.
Yeah.
So it's like, am I right?
You know, it's like, it's a little bit like, this is funny, right? I'm going to compare this to marriage, okay? Because
I've not been married, I don't know.
Me neither.
Okay.
And, but
let's talk about it.
Right? let's be the expert. You know, for a very long time, my brother got married when he was 27. And one of the things he kept saying that he didn't want, and he was dating somebody for 10 years. So they were dating since they were 17. And he kept saying he didn't want to get married because he's like, I want to get my MBA. I want to make my first million. And I want to be amazing by the time I get married, right? And then, I mean, come on, you're 27. This is India. Get the fuck married. So they ended up getting married at 27. And my brother was just starting his MBA at that point in time. And so I asked him, I said, is it, do you feel like you've compromised on something by getting married? And he said, actually, you don't understand that it's enabled me to do more. He's like, now that part of your brain that handles hormones, I guess. He's like, that is now so calm that I can literally direct my energies into other places. I know now when I come home, I have a loving person, a support system. Like, I know I have a person a phone call away who will sort of be my person, as it were. And he's like, he finished his MBA faster. He finished his MBA in a year and a half, which is not the thing that, I mean, and he was doing an executive MBA. So he was doing the weekend MBA. But he's like, he's finished it in a year and a half while simultaneously doing a job that required him to travel 4 days a week. And so I think it's that very same thing. It's that the relationship with having a manager was that I sort of was apprehensive. I was like, should I not? I don't want to commit. What's going to happen? Are they going to... And then the moment I did, I was like...
Take that leap. Yeah.
And again, it's taking the leap with the right person.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. That's the mistake a lot of people make.
You know, it's sort of... It enables you to do so much more. Like I'm sitting... By the way, I'm sitting here in England. I know I have work to go back to on 21st. I am landing in India on 19th. On 21st is my first gig. I have 24th, 20. Like I have already lined up. The dates are booked. The client has been informed of all the technical requirements. The, you know, the show flows have come to me. Everything is done. I literally now have to go show up. And that is, I mean, I have to just be amazing on stage, and I'm doing my job of being amazing on stage.
No, I spent a lot of my 20s, and I'm nearly 30 now, but I spent a lot of my 20s in that, like, wasting time on relationships and girls and the wrong people and all that kind of stuff, because I just needed to feel, first of all, I wanted to feel stuff, because you do when you're in your 20s, but also I wanted to feel mainly belonging, mainly a sense of social circle, because you lose that when you lose high school and when you leave uni and stuff. And I look back on it now, and I'm like, I say I look back on it, I'm only 29, but you look back on it and you're sort of like, I've got to a stage where I've gone, you know what, if a relationship happens, it happens, if sex happens, it happens. And now that I've gone that to myself, and also instead of me going where I used to go, I'm gonna be single forever, now I go, I'm gonna be single forever. Like the minute I looked at it with a different perspective, we were talking about before, different perspective, the minute I sort of went, you know what, so what, I don't get to have sex the rest of my life, fuck it, I've had it already, I'm happy with it, you know what I mean? Like the minute I let that go, I started putting energy into stuff that I actually wanted to do, and it's made my life better, because it's like, instead of me going with the social construct of you got to find a marriage, you got to find a girlfriend, you got to find whatever, I just go, what do I actually want to do with my life? And I can imagine for him taking that pressure off was finding that base, and for me it was not finding that base, but finding that base in myself,
in yourself, that's what it is. It's and why this job is actually inherently lonely. I think, you know, I mean, if especially if you're on the road and stuff, I'm telling you, I was gone for 13 days that day. I've been now away from home since the 5th of August, and I'm not going back till the 17th of September. And so I know I've been away from home, and I've sort of, I'm here all by myself. Like I'm walking around London a lot of, I'm spending a lot of time alone, just taking myself to shows and, you know, going and taking myself to a fancy dinner once in a while when I feel like I've done a good job. And if you can't find it here, then you're going to lead
She's pointing to her chest, by the way. Audio medium.
It's gonna be very lonely, and it's going, and loneliness can be very tiring. Not even like it's anything else, but just tiring, because you're so busy feeling sorry for yourself and feeling like you don't belong anywhere that it robs you of energy that could have been spent in other directions.
Definitely. I have quick fire finishing questions I ask everyone.
Yes.
We have covered quite a lot of them, so I'm gonna ask them again, and if you want to add to them, you can. If not, I'll just edit them out.
Okay.
So, what are the best books on comedy writing or stand-up you've ever read?
Born Standing Up by Steve Martin.
Right, Steve Martin, yeah.
He's so amazing. He has this... two amazing lines, right? One is of his where he's like, I would rather just be so good that they can't ignore you. Oh, what a line! And so, like, empowering instantly. Because then it's all about how good you are on stage and how much the audience wants to hear you talk. That's one. And the other one that he said, he was like, you know, when he had his first heartbreak and then he was talking to somebody and they said, that's going to happen a lot. And I think that's so awesome. And he goes, it instantly calmed him, because the knowledge that this gut-wrenching, horrible thing was going to happen to him time and time again was the most comforting thing on this planet. That's what I think is, you know, it sort of ties in with comedy, is that I know every time I have a bad show, I'm like, this is one, not the first time it's happening, and two, definitely not the last time it's happening. So I need to find the medium ground to sort of survive it and actually possibly make the best of it.
Yes, totally. What is the biggest mistake you've ever made, and how did you overcome it?
The biggest mistake I've ever made is not starting sooner, and actually not believing in myself, and not sort of just going out and doing this. I really wish I had started sooner. I wish I had displayed more faith in myself. And how to fix it? I think now I am fixing it. I'm in the process. I think I'll end up fixing it for the rest of my life, because you can never take back time.
Definitely. What is the biggest misconception people have of what you do?
There are a couple, right? One, like, my mother still thinks I'm going to get an actual job. My mother is still convinced. She's like, this comedy thing. Now, see, Aditi, now you're 30. Okay, which means that if you're starting in an ad agency, you'll still have to start from the bottom, Aditi. I was like, Mom, I'm really hoping to do this for a longer time. But so that's one. The second one is, of course, that if you are a female comedian, you only do male bashing. Let me clarify, I do everything bashing. I
am not.
Yeah, please. It's not. not that I'm not prejudiced. I hate everyone equally,
yeah,
kind of a thing.
Yeah, I love that thing. Yeah.
So I don't sort of, I prefer not to be, I guess, what is the word?
Pigeonholed
into that.
Both of those.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Who is the most underrated person in the industry?
Oh, you know, may I say this? The sound person at every gig we go to. Oh my God, I can't begin to tell you. Like, I feel a special relationship with the sound people and with the people in the bathroom. Like, you know, if there's ever a venue that has, like, you know, someone standing there and giving you, like, napkins or whatever.
They make me feel really uncomfortable. I agree with you on the sound guy.
But I think the sound guy and the bathroom person are my two favorite people at any gig, because I am a chronic piddler and... you know, I sort of constantly... And sound is... I mean, it's literally the only thing we have. It's possibly our biggest technical requirement is sound. And if that's not good, you could suffer a bad show.
There's a gig you should do in Leicester called Comedy in the Dark, where they where they don't let the light go on. So you have to do the performance.
Just, and yeah. That sounds amazing. Yeah. You know, so that's what, when I was writing this BBC show, and Ed, so my producer, the BBC 4 producer, Ed, he came to watch my special and was like, hey, you two like dance around and prance around on stage like it's going out of style. And I was like, hey, you know, I love that shit. And then he's like, you know, you know that the show we are writing, that's about whatever 40 minutes to 36 minute episodes, he's like, they're for radio. And I was like, oh. And when I started writing for that, it was kind of like Comedy in the Dark, because you know that on radio they're not going to be able to hear you. And it was just like, it was a revelation. I knew I had to cut out a ton of stuff, because I was like, oh, this is really dependent on me sort of making a stupid face, and this is really dependent on me making the hands, and you know, and all that stuff. And so I definitely want to do this gig.
I'll get you the details.
Please.
This is a two-parter and it's the last question. What is the best bit of advice you've ever been given? And if you could give one bit of advice to a comedian who wants to start a career in stand-up, what would you say?
One piece of advice, get on stage yesterday. Just get on stage, because the...
Get your time travel devices going.
Yes, hell yeah. Yeah, yeah. If you can go back in time and start 20 years ago when you were still in your mother's womb, do it. Like, yeah. I'd just be like, yo, what's the deal with the umbilical cord?
Yeah.
Like, I want to be that guy. Right?
Yeah.
So my advice to someone who is starting out is get on stage.
In my head, it was like, it comes back to babies and periods.
Doesn't it? And so, get on stage yesterday and don't be afraid to fail, because I think failure is as integral a part of this job as it is, as is the roaring success and the applause and the laughs. And what is the other one?
Best bit of advice you've ever been given.
This one's a survival piece, right? And this is from a comic that I don't really like much, to be honest. But he said something that, like, and it was after I had had a particularly bad set and I was sort of walking out, you know, sort of with my tail between my legs and my like sweat dripping out of my eyes or whatever. And he goes, so he's like, yeah, rough crowd, huh? And I was just like, what an asshole. And then he goes, you know, but let me tell you something, they were listening. And I was like, huh? And he's like, they were listening, it means they were interested. And I was like, what does that mean? And he said, see, one of the measures of how much an audience is listening to you is also in the times that they aren't laughing, that they aren't talking to each other. And I was like, oh yeah. He's like, that means they're listening. He's like, and that's not your battle won, but that's about 30% of your battle won, because your objective is to make them laugh. Otherwise, you've not done your job. But if they're listening, means they're not outright going like, this is not worth listening to. So there you go. And I was like, oh my God, I hate you, but thank you for this. Like, this made me feel better.
Definitely. That's great advice. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, it's been a pleasure. That was the DT. I loved talking to her. I found her a breath of fresh air, both in terms of her view on the UK scene. As she's not from here, she has a view on it from an outsider's perspective, which gives her the ability to see more of the faults and plus points than people who live here, who live and breathe it. And I also thought it was amazing to hear someone who wanted a career so badly that she had to make her own position in the industry to do it. There's something really motivating about that. And what surprised me the most was hearing about how the mainstream in Indian comedy is sexist, and as a result I wasn't surprised to hear that there is less females doing comedy over there. Overall, I found this episode really motivating though. It was really fun to put together, and I really hope you got some value out of it as well. If you did, please do consider tweeting myself or Aditi and saying thank you. It's always nice to be nice, and giving back to the guests really helps, and it's also just a lovely thing to do. So you can find all the links to her social media accounts on the show notes, which are at simonkane.co.uk. If you're new here, please do hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do remember to leave us an honest review in iTunes. And either way, please do consider giving a donation of some money to keep the show going. Without your donations, the show really would have to stop or slow down. So if you find any value in this and you've got a few quid spare, please do consider donating as little or as much as you can, either as a one-off donation via PayPal or as an ongoing donation on Patreon. Both of those links can be found on my website. Thank you very much for listening, thank you very much for subscribing, and thank you very much for donating if you do. I'll see you all in about 15 days' time. Bye!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.